Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson with Mage the Podcast, and joining me today is co-host Victor Kinzer. Victor, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm surviving Chicago winter, which from everything I've heard is nowhere near as bad as East Coast winter. I'm working with some people on the East Coast that have told me what's coming, and I hope you survive.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, the glory of the Allegheny Mountains in Pennsylvania means that, like, our winters are generally much more gentle than people, like, 35 miles to my west, and all of a thing that mountain ranges will do. But the thing we're discussing today are game tenets or game principles. Games contain not just setting to describe the world or place where games happen, and not just mechanics to drive play and dictate interaction, but to me, they also contain another set of technologies that guide play. These come together to form a set of informal and sometimes formal rules for the game. These tenets or principles are often not explicitly stated, but now often are. So you would have the idea in older games that theme and mood were created by description of the setting as well as the mechanics. So for instance, there is a certain amount of horror that is hard to avoid in a lot of World of Darkness games just because there's a botch mechanic and willpower is a thing that gets to be depleted. So you often have theme and mood that come about from mechanics, but there's also kind of a separate thing entirely where you can just kind of list what the goals are and communicate that with players.
I've played a couple games with explicit tenets, and like you mentioned, there are always kind of tenets there, but in older games they weren't really called out. They are an explicit part of character and chronicle creation in V5, and I've played a couple V5 games that used them. And the thing that I think is kind of interesting about game tenets is I think they were created as an explicit thing to help players engage with theme, because engaging with themes and character motivations and a lot of these abstract ideas that especially more narrative games try to focus on is something that if you come from a background of drama or narrative writing, you've learned how to do that more than likely, either formally in some sort of school or just through practice. But a lot of people come to this with a board game mentality. Either they came through D&D or they've never role played before and they're like, I'm going to play a game. And in their head are a bunch of board games and card games. And the tenets are a really interesting way to kind of say, all right, I'm going to put the fact that this is all about character and storytelling and theme right in front of you and make it explicit because maybe you'll miss the prompt otherwise. And I think that's really cool. But I also think in my experience and kind of looking through a lot of the tenets you had in the outline for this, it struck me that a lot of tenets would be really great for new players and a lot of tenets would be really great for very experienced players. And they're not the same tenets a lot of the times. So I think it's really important to look at the type of game you're going to play. And like session zero is so important when thinking about tenets. So you can kind of get a sense of where are my players? Are they going to like jump in and figure out character and theme? And we're going to like go deep with this. Or is this really an assistance tool to just get them into the headspace of this kind of play? Because I think you approach it very differently.
And I think to some extent, it is a roomy velvet straitjacket in that over my years of playing games and talking to a lot of people who've played Dungeons and/or Dragons and similar games, as well as World of Darkness players, there is kind of this weird notion of what is fair. So for instance, there's kind of the theory that says, I have bought this adventure is already appropriately balanced. If my players can make it through this adventure, like the Sword Coast Adventure series or something, or Baron von Ravenloft or something like that, my players have played well and were maybe a little bit lucky. And that if I nudge the rules in some way, or I fudge a role to influence the outcome, that is in some way unfair. That it is a group working through the puzzle that is the module. Another version of that is kind of and this seems to pop up in White Wolf games more than I found in other games, that there is a story. The storyteller has come up with it. They have populated the world, and things like mysteries and puzzles have correct answers, and it is on me to find them. And if I do, I will get an interesting and engaging story. And then there's a few steps back from that, kind of this, Robin Laws and Pelgrim are big fans of this, where it's like, no, no, we want everyone to have fun. So if we can nudge the game in the direction of fun, we should do that. That doesn't mean the players always win, but the players should be in some way satisfied. And sometimes that involves ignoring the rules, as well as doing things like, well, the characters put together all the clues and they came up with this as the cause. Anything that connects all of the clues in a reasonable way is the right answer. The idea being no one enjoys playing the game of guess what the storyteller is thinking. And game tenets to me are a useful way to have something to point to when the storyteller maybe deviates from what a die roll says or from what the book establishes. So I think they are in one way freeing and in another way restrictive.
I would totally agree with that. And I think that this really goes back to the sort of irony in creative work that restrictions are freeing. There is nothing as oppressive as a blank page. But if you have a prompt, if you're given parameters, if you're given limitations, it's like your brain pushes against that and engages. And I feel like the tenants ideally are that sort of mechanism, especially with Mage, more so than I would say any other World of Darkness game. You can do kind of whatever you want. I sometimes love that. I sometimes hate it as a storyteller, but especially for new players, I find it's overwhelming. And so things like rotes, things like tenants, things that say, this is the type of magic we're going to do, not because you couldn't go further with your spheres, but because that wouldn't be good for the story we've all decided we want to tell together. I feel like it sparks the imagination and at least gives you an idea of where to start. And so in that respect, it's freeing, but it does technically put some limitations on you. You know, if you create a bunch of tenets about a street level game, about the rareness of magic, and then someone comes in and says, I'm going to become a void engineer and I'm going to get on the next space flight. And you're just like, no, you're not. That's not happening. That's not open to you in this chronicle.
Or alternatively, great. Now roll up the character that will engage with the story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Premise rejection is real. So we're going to talk about a bunch of different types of tenets or principles. One is that of the game tenet. These are directives given to the storyteller or GM or whatever by the game itself, in the sense that the authors of the game state these explicitly. They help define the theme and mood for a game if the game has a defined theme and mood. They tend to be short and guide both description and mechanics. Powered by the Apocalypse calls these principles, and most good Powered by the Apocalypse games that I know of have them. For instance, Urban Shadows 2E, the game we all want to secretly be playing, has some moves that I like. If you'd like more information on this, see my conversation with Mark Diaz Truman, where I am very much punching above my weight in terms of interview guests that I get. And it says, display the city from the skyline to the slums, cloak your moves in darkness, dirty the hands of all involved, give everything a price, especially friendship. These are directions given to the person running the game, the GM, and they are all commands. Do this. It is not advice. It is defining the game. If we wanted Mage to be a little more definitive, we could add these in. So one of the things that always gets me is the statement, Mage can be anything. Sure, there to me are kind of spheres of anythingness. Like, for instance, there's a certain thing of urban horror to gothic horror to urban adventure that Mage, I think, does pretty well. There's also kind of a weird cosmic angle that I think it does pretty well. You can make it be a period romance, but I don't think it's really built for that. But you can make it be that. So I tried the exercise of, based on M20 as received, what would it be? And I am specifically ignoring Book of the Fallen, Technocracy Reloaded, and Rich Bastard's Guide, because to me, those would be supplements that would have their own tenets. But like the first three books or so, one is make magic a last resort. Mage seems to want it to be that not every problem is solved with magic. That is something that is kind of explicitly said in the game. This could indicate that magic is costly, that there is some resource that is chewed up, or paradox is particularly punitive. Another one is the idea that make Magic a last resort could be remind the players that they generally have a good mundane option. Another idea is that Magic is dangerous or could attract unwanted attention or tends to get out of hands. Another one, if I wanted to add one to M20, would be something like remind players that corruption and madness are always close by. This could mean that the Marauders or Nafandi are a constant struggle, or that you are often being tugged away by the gentle pull of quiet or infernalism. Another one is show that the masses yearn, but that they do not act first, which is the idea that one of the ideas that Mage has is there is still imagination, wonder, and hope left in the world, but mortals left to their own devices are not very good at creating and harnessing it, where mages are really good at that. Maybe mortals may be interested in something that adds wonder, but they won't seek it out in most cases. Or this could be a description of paradox, that it will come for you if you actually do magic. Another one would be make up whatever shit you want. The setting can handle it. And that was my attempt at coming up with like three tenets of M20 as I see it. What do you think about the idea of coming up with those tenets for Mage to cover what I'll say the games that the books as presented kind of think you should be playing?
I love and I hate this. And I'll tell you why I love and I hate this. The reason I struggle with this is, and anyone who's listened to me on Walking Away from Arcadia knows this is not limited to Mage. I don't play these games as they're written. The first one of these gets right to the core of what I struggle with World of Darkness. Make Magic a last resort. I hate the idea that mages know what they're doing. Some mages know what they're doing. Your hermetics know what they're doing. Your syndicate mages, your really high-level technocrats, they know what they're doing. Your euthanatos knows what they're doing. But especially when you're working with orphans or you're working at the very street level, I like the idea that a lot of magic is happening because of belief about the way the world works. And I know that when I look at you and I bat my eyes a certain way and I say a certain thing, that you are more inclined to agree with me. And that's just become an organic, natural part of who and what I am. And I have to learn the hard way that I shouldn't do that too often. And then as I advance, I begin to understand what that really is. And yes, I've gone to Ars Cupididae because I'm a horrible person and I always go to Ars Cupididae. Storytellers hate me. I really like the idea that when you're at that very punk street level that Mage purports to be, that these sorts of tenets speak to the player. They don't speak to what your character knows or understands. And I know a lot of Mage players disagree with me on this, but you kind of know that you're special in a way that maybe everyone else isn't, but you don't always know as a character when you're rolling Arete. You as a player know you're rolling Arete. And so then it becomes about, as a player, telling a story about this character who does not have all the information that I have, the writer's dilemma, what are the themes that are going to emerge? So Make Magic a last resort is that don't always roll magic, or is that I'm too young to not know to use magic all the time, and we're going to tell a story about learning that Make Magic should be a last resort, or that magic should be a last resort. And I think the place that I really love in Mage is really getting down and understanding that you and your character do not understand what's happening the same way, especially in Mage. You have 9 spheres on your sheet. And if you are not playing a member of the Order of Hermes, your character doesn't care about those 9 spheres. They just don't. And so I think that these sorts of tenets can be good, but I also feel like if they're not really well constructed, they can end up having a different effect than you mean them to have, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. And many of them are multiply interpretable. The other thing is, it is different to give a tenant to a table versus giving it to a storyteller.
That's true.
And I certainly agree on the point of character knowledge versus player knowledge. As I storytell more, I spend more and more time avoiding the parlance of magic with a K as much as humanly possible. To the point as you say, I like the world where mages don't realize they're necessarily always doing magic, like they're hitting the Arete button. The thing that is bothersome is M20 is explicitly Crowleyan in saying that all magic comes from the will, and in some places saying mages know this. And I'm like, you don't got me on that one. in my write-up for Lore of the Traditions, my description of the Celestial Chorus does not hammer on that, because I put them in the list of people that maybe they don't know that they're doing magic necessarily. But those were my attempt at coming up with things out of M20 as received. And your comment, it's really hard to come up with this. Amen to that. I've backed a few games with principles or tenets in them, and to see how they changed from the Kickstarter preview to the ultimate game, you're like, huh. One of my favorite similar examples of this is the Root RPG. In either the pre-release copy or the first edition of it, one of the character moves was murder exclamation mark, which got changed to strike out with violence. Those are similar, but very different. So make magic a last resort and have characters realize that magic only seems free or something like that, mm-hmm. can generate very different things. So yeah, wording certainly matters. Another kind of tenet we have are character tenets, which apply to a group or a character. These would be useful statements of political principle within a game or a thing about character belief. For instance, Exalted uses ties and principles, which are great things to steal in Mage, to replace or supplement nature and demeanor. Principles are statements the character feels are true. I use feel in the sense that we cannot say that they are objectively true, but they do stand behind them with great force. In Exalted, convincing someone to go against a principle is quite hard and is a powerful way to resist coercion. In Exalted, these statements are generally statements of fact to the character instead of commands. For instance, a character may have a personal principle of the wheel must turn, which guides them to help settle the affairs of the restless dead or kill vampires. Another may have a principle of to experience all is to know all, which allows them to try new things. The former could allow a character with that principle to resist domination and presence, and to experience all is to know all may allow a character to roll willpower or rite to resist a poison. Mechanically, a character may receive a bonus to defend against coercion, and this could help guide adjudicating mind abilities. Mind often wonders, would a character do this anyway? And principles can help answer that. If Mind 2 could get someone to do something they would do anyway, Mind 3 is getting them to do something they could go either way on, Mind 4 is something they wouldn't do, and Mind 5 lets you kind of rewrite it or get them to do something they strongly wouldn't do, a principle could make something suddenly require Mind 5 or at least 4 to fight. Normally a tired sentry for a remote earthly aspect of the Lodge of the Gray Squirrel being convinced not to investigate a weird noise on a frigid night, maybe Mind 2. But Mind 4, if the sentry has the principle of defend the chantry from all possible enemies internal and external. Principle stated as a command can also guide regaining willpower. In 1 in E and 2E, you regained willpower when you fulfilled your nature, and revised onward, you get it from a good night's rest. So suddenly, when you get to lean into one of your principles in a way that is narratively important to the game, that could be a willpower trigger. So something like see that the old ways are preserved, your character gains willpower back every time that they lead a bunch of mortals in some sort of act or rite. They celebrate the Spring Harvest Festival, they celebrate Samhain, they celebrate some holiday or something with a group of mortals for the first time, and suddenly you're regaining willpower from that. And it gives you a lot more variety than just nature autocrat or nature celebrant. In Eldritch and cosmic horror games, you may use character tenets to resist the sanity grinding power of some terrors. Seeing Grinsler the Void manifest may send most people, even hardened technocracy agents, screaming, but my principle of the masses must be protected from threats beyond reality allows me to ignore the effects of the Void terror's field, while at the same time doing nothing against a Zemisi horror vozd that has suddenly appeared. Principles can be a trigger for XP growth if upholding them causes adversity. If in the process of defending the masses or what have you, you do something with great peril or cost, suddenly you have an XP trigger. Finally, some games give a mechanic where sacrificing a principle in some way can give a brief but powerful bonus. A tenet or principle can be sacrificed, leaving a void. I'm kind of chewing on an idea of like having everyone come up with 5 principles for their character. Like, what is your attitude towards magic? What is your attitude towards other mages? What is your attitude towards the Ascension War? What is your attitude towards sleepers? And what is your attitude towards Ascension itself? And maybe what is your attitude towards Nightfolk in a crossover game? And I think that would be a wonderful session zero thing to be like, what areas do we want to plan out where we agree and disagree? I like walking into a game kind of knowing if there's someone at the table my character will get along with and someone that they don't, as opposed to just letting that emerge through gameplay, because just letting it emerge through gameplay works, but that has resulted in some fantastically clunky sessions where, yeah, two characters are arguing about paradigm, but the bad guy's getting away. That's fun once, but the seven times it's happened, I'm just like, come on. As you mentioned, you've played the world of Darkness V5 games. What do you think about what I said about character tenants and how do they do it?
So character tenants in V5 really tie into humanity. So you create your character tenants and they kind of take the place of the hierarchy of sins in previous editions. And in that respect, they gave you kind of a very light path mechanism. Now, obviously, they later released Sabbat and got deep into extremist paths. But the idea that an affront to your morals will be different person to person is built into the beginning system. It's just not nearly as dramatic as it is with paths in previous editions. So I like the idea that character tenants are tied to some aspect of mage system. So when I was hearing you talk about like the different levels of mind, the thing that I would really like to see written up for this is something that illuminates what the different levels of spheres actually do. I wouldn't want to actually replace the way the spheres are written up. And so with mind, I was thinking about the fact that at second level, you can, you know, put a nudge, you can imprint an emotion, but you can't put a whole thought in someone's head. Whereas at third level, you can sort of transmit a thought, an idea. At fourth level, you can construct memory, you can get kind of deeply manipulative. And then fifth level, really, you're kind of creating a whole mind pattern. But you could also say that if you are creating enough structure that is different from what was already there, you need mind five. And so I like the idea of expressing what you have here in those terms, because I find that a lot of players have a hard time grasping what they can really do with each level. And so going back to that system and reinforcing it and saying, all right, with mind two, you can't put an idea in someone's head, but you can sort of look at them, see the ideas that are there, and just put in an emotion that nudges them towards the idea that's already there that you want them to get to and express it that way. And then with mind three, you can put an idea in there. If it is strongly opposed to all the other ideas, they're going to filter it out, but you can introduce something new. At four, you can start to manipulate the memory and the infrastructure. So maybe they would lean towards something that they wouldn't have otherwise gone towards because you've made them remember a traumatic experience from their childhood that never really happened. And then at mind five, you can do some actual big architectural restructuring. We're probably pushing the need for mind five there, if we're being honest, but like that is an example. I think that game tenants could be used as a really interesting reflection to make the spheres more intuitive in that respect. So I really like that system. I just love to see that built out. The other thing that I was thinking of is I really like the idea of character tenants as a way to express paradigm, because while M20 has the best version of paradigm Mage has ever had, it's aging at this point. We've kind of used it enough that we've seen where it succeeds and where it doesn't. And I really like paradigm, but I feel like the write-ups are big and abstract, and sometimes players don't totally internalize all of them. And I like the idea that if you took like Might Makes Right, there were a list of example character tenants. You could say you would believe some of these things, or you could make up other things in this theme and have some of that that you could just have on your character sheet that you'd be looking back at occasionally as a way to get willpower, as a way to say, I am doing something that is really intrinsically aligned with the way I believe magic works, like really aligned with it. And so maybe I get, you know, a lower difficulty on my magic, give some systematic bonuses that get your characters to go back to their paradigm on a regular basis. I like the idea of tying it to a main game mechanic that way, the way V5 ties it to humanity roles.
Might Makes Right is fascinating because there is a reading of it where it's a political philosophy, but there is that paradigmic reading that comes up in a bunch of different weird places. Like Might Makes Right is both what the hermetic willpower-based, I am forcing my will onto the onto reality, as well as the neo-pagan who believes they are taking on a mantle because they have demonstrated the appropriate control and self-refinement to do it. Like, as you mentioned, the paradigms are huge and sometimes hard to explain. Like, a mechanistic cosmos includes both the celestial bureaucracy and scientific reductionism. And it's like, duh? Like sometimes another title will do it, but like All the World Is Data both covers both like a simulationist reality as well as the idea that we are like the dream stuff of the first ones or something like that. Like you get to these really weird places where you're like, how are these both the same? So like a bunch of different tenets where you could pick one or two in like short punchy statements. Yeah, I do think that would be helpful too. Add that to the list of Storytell Revolt books we'll never have a chance to do. The last kind we have are setting or chronicle tenets. And setting tenets are a way to try and compress a lot of information into a small space and describe the world of the game and philosophy the storyteller will use in realizing it. I feel that these are very useful because your characters have an intuitive understanding of the world and what represents a threat or not. For instance, I had a playgroup that did not like the Umbra because they didn't know what a threat looked like. There was a pirate ship coming up the River of Language, and they're like, is this a thing we run from, or is this a kooky opportunity for role-playing? And they just didn't know. Whereas in the normal setting we had, if a limousine came up to them that had tinted windows, there's a couple of ways that can go. If all the windows roll down at once and people with guns start like leaning out, it is clear what is a threat and what is not. And to me, chronicle tenets help really dial that in. M20 gives a lot of options on how to dial in a game experience in what I consider to be one of the most frustrating ways, in that it will do things like say, hey, if your characters are doing something that is breaking the story, you can introduce a paradox spirit. And, oh, they bought this 5-dot wonder, which I think is great. Make sure they realize it's not free. Like, you took it to character creation. It's literally not free. Like, they spent 10 background points to get this wonder. Give it to them. But the game is frequently like, make sure people try and steal it or have it break periodically. It uses these ex post facto things where, to me, a game tenant can really state it ahead of time. Where if I have a game tenant of the stronger the magic, the less reliable its form, I've kind of warned them. One of the personal ones I use is the snake will always rattle before striking. Violence is always possible, but rarely preferred. Overwhelm, avoid, or retreat, but never duel. That is my sign to my players that I will not suddenly introduce something that will kill you. You will always get a warning, and you will always have one round to respond. And that just, to me, frees up the game a lot.
Yeah, I like the way you described that in terms of sort of projecting to your players how you're going to do certain things. I have a very similar frustration with Mage. That whole make sure you break the thing, or don't let someone go too far, or put a disadvantage on this really powerful wonder. I don't do any of that. I basically, when I get to that part of text in the Mage books, I just skip a paragraph and move on with my life. But I handle it a little differently in that I'll give you the fifth level wonder that does a ridiculous thing, but there will always be someone out there who has enough friends to do an extended ritual to come back on you if you get their attention. So I'm always going to let you do the crazy thing. And so having a tenant like, there is no magic so powerful that it can't get the attention of someone more powerful. Having a tenant like that also sort of communicates that you can buy a thing, you can use it. And if you're careful and considered in how you use it and obfuscating that you did it and considering the setting, you'll be good. But like, don't be flagrant because it's Mage and repercussions. And if I didn't bring something bigger than you to play every couple of games, the game would get boring. So just remember that that's always going to happen. And so I like the idea of having a couple tenants that you just create as the storyteller. I also think with chronicle tenants, for most of them, it's really important for your troop to define the chronicle tenants when they get to story and narrative theme. That was the thing I liked the most in V5 is, I think in V5 you just choose like one, and I don't even know that it's a tenant. I think they're called, it's basically like your ethics, because it's all framed around kind of that humanity mechanic, but you do pick one as a coterie. And I really like the idea of picking a couple Chronicle tenants as a group, maybe not just one, that really speak to what are the types of stories we want to tell? What are the types of threats we're interested in overcoming? Because that helps me a lot as a storyteller. And I've done the whole thing where I look at my players and I say, what themes do you want to inspect? And I get blank stares, unless I'm working with, you know, people who come from drama or writing, et cetera. But most of the time, if they're just there to play a game, they're kind of like, there's a reason I'm not the storyteller. But I think asking them to come up with tenants, again, it puts restrictions around what you're doing that sparks creativity. So I like that part of it.
And I like the idea, to modify what something I said earlier, I like the idea that your troop comes up with a few shared character tenants. Like, if you want that lubrication to make sure that your group gets along, like, literally everyone in this group has the tenant, the technocracy will pay for their crimes. We may have six different ways of interpreting it, but like, the technocracy will pay for their crimes, and the Nefandi are insidious and everywhere. To some extent, like, defines the disparate alliance, and also we must face the future without forgetting who we are, or something like that. Now I would love to see what are the tenets for each of the political factions in the game, and that kind of mechanically that is useful because we know everyone around the table has a few things pushing in the same direction. But I also like the idea that, like, personally, almost all the characters would have something like, the Ascension War will never touch my family, or something like that. And that kind of creates this shared sense of, I don't know much about this other mage, but I do know this. The Chronicle tenants I had in my most recent game, which at this point was a year ago. Yeah, I know, I need to run more mage. That isn't a one-shot. So is, all beliefs matter and have power. All people have beliefs and their worlds reflect. This is to say, all earnestness or just widely held belief can nudge the world, and passive belief can create a lot of subtle changes in the world around them. I like the idea that resonance in a little way is kind of everywhere, and it just explains kind of a lot of the odd things in life. The second tenet, the choice to abandon humanity is a conscious choice. The hole we dig is deep, but is never bottomless. This is my way of saying you can always come back from infernalism. You can always come back from being a Nefandis, but it's going to be hard. This prevents characters from dismissing bad guys as irretrievably anything. Third is, there is other magic beyond the spheres in the world. It is rare and it is strange. One thing that bothers me is the tendency to view of mages to make all other magic just some kind of magic with a K, that fey magic is just a weird use of the spheres, or sorcery is just something like that. And I think they should have different rules and can do neat things. I'm constantly thinking about things like, mage magic is the letter of the law, and fey magic is frequently the spirit of the law. Like, a fey magical effect will gain power over centuries, but be kind of squirrely in its implementation, where mage magic, since it is so will-directed, tends to be more straightforward in a lot of cases. My fourth one is, there are other things in the night. They are a step away from humanity. We may be a step forward for it. This is my way of saying that mages don't have to be monsters, but it's easy for them to be one. Fifth, mortals are not cattle. They are not wise, but they are not stupid. We work in their shadow, which is my way of saying sleepers dominate the world. There's no secret vast conspiracy, but there's a reason the world doesn't know about the Ascension War, and it's not because it's not happening. Sixth, because you pursue hope does not make you a hero. Because you cause pain does not make you a villain. Mage resists easy classifications of good and evil. The Ascension War is internal and external and has 10,000 faces. The main battlefronts are Earth and inside of us. This is my way of saying that I always want the game to be pointing at the mundane side of the gauntlet, that the Umbra is interesting, but it is a step away from my core game. Eighth, the path to power is hard, the path to wisdom is hidden, the path to decadence is gentle. This is my way of justifying that self-enrichment and slipping into, like, infernalism should be easy, that it should be hard work. There's a reason it is the path of thorns to ascend. And ninth, the snake will always rattle before striking. Violence is always possible, but rarely preferable. Overwhelm, avoid, or retreat, but never duel. This is my way of saying I'll warn you if I'm going to use deadly force, but also that once the players have made their move, I will not hold back from the antagonists. You get one shot at the hit mark before the chain gun comes out of its arms. And those are the ones I used in my most recent game. Obviously, I would change those for different settings. And I could also include more if I wanted to bang on about theme and mood and so on. But I feel these did a acceptable job of explaining to players, of which in this case, 4 out of 5 of them, or 3 out of 5 of them, were first-time mage players. And it didn't not work. There were some places where it came shining through, and there were other cases where it was clear. It was like, oh, we are not on the same page. What did you think about those, Victor? Or alternatively, if you had to come up with tenants for your most recent game, what do you think they would have been?
I like a lot of these tenants. I feel like some of them speak to the fact that maybe you've had different experience with mage players than I have. The one that really stood out to me was the whole idea of mages thinking that all magic is just another kind of magic with a K. And in my most recent campaign, which is the first time I've really tried to do like street level, you know, low level concerns kind of mage. And I still can't keep myself away from political games. So I have built very street level political factions, and I introduced the players to some other supernaturals because one of those factions is being run by an intensely anti-establishment orphan who was raised by two sorcerers. So she was raised her entire life around the supernatural before she ever awakened. And I did that because it meant that once she awakened, she could start collecting broken things, collecting discarded vampires and Ronin shifters and thrown away dolls before the rest of the anime found them. And she did all that because she had been exposed to sorcerers and maybe the mages who were abusing her parents, etc. And she saw what happened when mages extend themselves, but she was also exposed to other street level things. And so she never believed that whatever she could do was the only thing, but she also recognized that they can all do magic and come together and we can create an organization and we won't be so susceptible to paradox. And just having that insight has given her so much leverage over the other arguably much more powerful mages in the city, and also made her very, very unpopular with those mages for disrupting norms around Nightfolk. And all of the players, when they saw a vampire for the first time, because I told them to all make very street level intro mages, they all have their firm belief and they went, wait, vampires are real? And the idea that it's just fear magic, man, that never got through the shock response. And they were all role playing that. They all know the world of darkness at least fairly well. So that wasn't player bleed. That was, what is my character? What do they really know? What do they understand about anything? Half these people are effectively orphans. They've never been trained by anybody. And the other half are barely initiated on the edge of a tradition or a craft. And so I think that whole dynamic of, oh, mages just think everything is fear magic, that's players playing the game as their characters. And I like the idea that this tenant can be a way to remind you that, no, that's not how this works. You don't think that. Why would you think that? There's maybe like this tiny middle point in your development where you're developed enough to have gotten an ego, but you're not so developed that you've seen all the things that don't work the way sphere magic works and you really have seen behind the curtain, because those mages don't think that either. You get into deviant files with the technocracy, etc. So I like the idea that you could maybe pick a tenant that speaks to the moment in magical awareness development you want your characters to be at. That's what that kind of spoke to me, is I didn't express it explicitly as a tenant in my game, but I did set in the prompt, this is the kind of experience and lens you should have on the world broadly. And it was intentionally broad enough that they could be traditionalists or orphans or disparates. It was a mystic street level game. But I think tenants are a more structured way to do that. So that's a lot of what I was thinking about when I read that tenant in particular. I think the other ones resonated with me more directly in terms of capturing emotional theme. I really liked the one about the Nefandus and the infernalism and the just stating outright that we're going to say in this campaign, yes, you can come back. Because I've had that my very, very first mage game before I was good about setting theme with my players. This was in mid-college. I hit a moment where I wanted to introduce this, hey, maybe this character is leaning towards becoming a marauder because something very, very, very traumatic happened to her. It was a massive dice botch at the wrong moment. And I said, hey, you want to have this actually break your mind? And she was like, yeah, let's do it. And the first time I had a sort of systematic indicator, the other players all went, well, she's a marauder, we have to kill her. And I was just like, well, that's not a very interesting story. And I could not talk them out of it. And I realized it's because we'd come into this game with just very different assumptions. So I like the way this could level set some of that stuff and head off those sort of hard collisions, because you at least kind of know how the other is thinking about the game.
I also like the idea, and this is kind of a background thought for me, that points of permanent quiet to me should be about as permanent as points of permanent willpower. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot for it to go up. It takes a lot for it to go down. So it's kind of like the steady state unless you do something. I guess there's the argument that say the nature of being a marauder is such that you will start accumulating points of permanent mm-hmm. quiet, as it were. But I have a series of episodes I want to do on like rethinking certain factions within the game, and I have no idea how to do it. Like, I came up with this quiet system that I kind of like, that I want to roll out into the world at some point, that is basically like, there's a reason people fall to the calls, and there's a reason that people snap, and there should be strong mechanical encouragement to giving up your sanity or morality. Like, you should get something. It shouldn't just be the Nafandi are effective because they don't have a sense of good holding them back. I think they should have more dice in the dice pool at certain points. But yeah, I like that, where it was just like, well, she's a marauder, we have to kill her. And I think of the things in M20, I think the threat of marauderdom is underplayed. I really think that mm-hmm. should be lurking, just because, like, I don't know, like, me falling to evil is not something I personally worry about, but me kind of slipping into a certain kind of madness is something that I as a person do, where I'm like, oh, has my worldview become so calcified that I basically have a denial quiet in some way? Like, there are certain opinions I have about the state of the world that probably leads me to ignore certain things. Like, likewise, are there certain comforting truths that I cling to so hard that I am in some way delusional? So I generally find quiet to be the more personally compelling aspect to things, as opposed to jure, or however we would want to measure, like, Nafondic taint. I think the quiet side of things is much more compelling to me.
I think it also depends on how you get to Nafondic taint. So I was playing in a mage campaign, and my storyteller was being very, very bleak, and he wanted to do this hard, edgy, end-of-the-world post-apocalyptic story where we actually saw the apocalypse. And I had written a very idealistic character. Like, I was an orphan, and I honestly believed I could bridge the divide between the technocracy and the traditions. And I wrote it being like, this is never going to happen. This character's an idiot. But I wanted to play this really strong idealistic character and have him deal with how that tends to play out in Mage. And when all of the evil things that were going to cause this mystic apocalypse started to happen, he went down a path of throwing lures to the calls at us. And most of us went, no, absolutely not. We see what that is. And my character was very hardline about it. And one of the other characters went, no, I'm going to pick these up because it's fun, because power. And we were all a little annoyed about it. But, you know, it was what it was. And then as the game progressed and things really started to fall apart and some really horrible things happened to my character, I went, okay, we've all been playing this. Loof is going to become an Nafandis and we can all see it. And it's so obvious and we're going to kill him. And I took him aside and I went, I want to slowly become an Nafandis, not for power. I have rebuked every single offer you've thrown at me, but because my faith in anything good being possible is dying, because you've been telling this incredibly bleak game. And I want to be the Nafandi who legitimately hates being and is not in it for power and no longer believes any of that stupid naivete of my youth is possible. And he was just, his jaw just hit the floor. And I went, no, I want to do this. And none of the other players will see it coming. And it's going to be horrible and tragic and they will kill me. And it's fine. And I think it would have been a great story. And the players eventually burned out on the edgelordiness of it all. And I never got to play it because that chronicle ended.
Nice. I'm sorry you didn't get to play out that fall. But it kind of reminds me, there was a Mr. Nichols, I think, is the character who is a marauder because they think the world is genuinely good. I do like the idea of there being a point where you uphold your tenant too much and it triggers quiet or something like that, where it's like, okay, you've invoked your tenant for the fourth time this session. Or something like that, where there is that thing where it's like, oh, look what they did for true love, but true love that isn't reciprocated is called obsession. So I think it would be neat to have that mechanic to tip over from one to the other, where you go from, no, things are going to turn out okay, and you're being like, wow, that's really your rock in this world, to you believe in that so fervently as a mage that your avatar has internalized it and it is generating the lollipop guild in the hobgoblins. That's the thing I now want to do, and since I'm the one who brought it up, it's kind of on me to do it.
Yeah, I really going back to the whole like tying tenants to existing game systems, I would love if for your personal tenants, you assigned each one a residence and overusing a tenant, like if you overused a tenant and there'd be some system around, overusing it too much, the storyteller could make you write an obsessive, dysfunctional version of it. They could look at you and say, you've invoked this like three times a game for the last three sessions. You're becoming obsessed. Write a dysfunctional version of it. And which gets a little Wraith shadowy. Like, I like the idea of making the player do it so you're not just like inflicting obsessiveness on them, not telling them how to play their character, but just saying, all right, you've pushed this far. You knew that this was a possibility. Now, like, write the Klopothic version of your character virtue.
I think the direction I would take that is something like the character tenant is what the character believes, which influences the way they practice magic, which generates resonance. And resonance, in most cases, is the way in which we communicate with our avatar. And now you get to write an avatar tenant.
Ooh, oh, I like that.
Yes. So a character with three dots of fiery resonance because they keep blowing up technocracy things, suddenly the avatar gets technology must burn as an avatar tenant, and that starts influencing what a paradox backlash looks like, what your quiet is going to look like. Now, if you didn't get enough sleep, your cell phone looks like it's on fire or something like that. But I like the idea that one of the things running around the back of my head is how do characters talk to their avatar? I like the idea that avatars are intelligent but highly alien. And we never quite know what they're going to pick up, which is why things to me like manifest and circumspect avatar should be rare, and things that are used
Ooh.
to keep mage weird, even for mages. But that's just me.
No, I really like the idea of something like you have a resonance of fire, you are a fiery personality, you're associated with fire, and you start to push that resonance or that tenant, and you end up with an avatar tenant, and maybe things start happening like you wake up frigid and cold, and you pick up your cell phone and you see a phone number illuminated. And it isn't until you call that phone number and do the thing your avatar is pushing you to do that you'll feel warm again. And you can get out of those sorts of effects if you get back into balance, if you stop giving your avatar such an easy button to push. And that, the avatar views you as a vessel. I don't think the avatar should treat you in a kind or emotionally functional way. And so the skill of setting boundaries with your avatar should be something a mage really needs to develop. And so I like the idea of manifestations like that being part of how you're driven. I could also see those sorts of effects driving a technocrat and then being able to brush that off more easily than the there's a person I talked to in the mirror. Yeah.
Another thing, you and I were talking before the show about how much I'm enjoying Order of Reason as a book. One of the ideas presented there is that the daemon is something that needs to be almost overcome, that technocrats recognize, or Daedalians, to use the contextual term, understand that there is this part of you that is pulling you towards superstitionist activities or sorcerous beliefs, and it will frequently give you ways out of problems, but they will be vain. So I like the idea that accumulated resonance gives an easy leverage point for your avatar to do, because it can't make you do anything. It can constantly pester you, but it can take away and give you resonance.
Yeah.
I like that as a mechanical idea. You can certainly help build it up and take it down, or what have you. I like that. Put it on the list of systems we're never going to get around to writing up, but wish we did.
Yes,
Yeah.
absolutely. That is a long list.
Yes, it is a pretty impressive list. Any other thoughts before maybe we look at some of the tenants some listeners submitted?
No, I like the idea of jumping into the listener tenants. They were interesting.
And so we got a couple of different classes of tenants. Some are advice to storytellers, and many of those were quite good, but they were more advice to storytellers than anything else. So if you submitted one and you don't hear it, it may have been that. But a lot of them were great. Look at the Discord channel for this show, and you will see a lot of what I think is very concise storyteller advice. It may not work for you because you're not running that kind of game. The thing Victor was talking about, how big Mage can be, and kind of before the show, we were talking about, I'm like, yeah, Mage can be big, but there's kind of this area that it naturally wants to sit in, But it being mage, no one can agree on what that area of naturally wanting to sit in was. One of my favorite little mage anecdotes were the people who really loved mage because they thought it was a libertarian power fantasy. And I'm like, well, can't tell you you're wrong.
I mean, I had this argument with a friend early on, and he is not a libertarian. He actually didn't like mage so much initially because it's all about exceptional people that should actually be running things and are more capable and can make more of a difference than everyone else. And he described it that way. And I went, that is absolutely not the messaging once you get into the story, but I totally cannot argue with that pitch being the surface. Like, that's the elevator pitch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first one I got was, Mikhail writes, reality is malleable but thorny. I like this as a way of saying things could be made adjusted, but you may get poked. I could see a character in world saying something like, we mold reality like clay, but the clay often contains rocks and shards of glass. Mages can do great things, but it is often the case that other nightfolk powers can kind of do something more specific better. I was recently on a podcast and they were talking about how would you emulate these magical effects from other games using mage, and kind of my premise rejection was like, you wouldn't. Like, in mage, you wouldn't have Bite Beast clenched fist. If your goal is to hit a guy with forces or to crush them, like, you wouldn't create an invisible fist and punch them in most cases. You drop a building on them or crush them with gravity or something like that. To get a specific instantiation in mage is often very hard. One of my favorite dichotomies is, and this is mentioned in How Do You Do That? And this is either beautiful or infuriating, depending on how you kind of look at it. If you want to create massive forces damage, you can use forces 5 to come and summon a lightning storm. If you specifically need a lightning storm across a broad area, though, suddenly you need time 2, entropy 3, forces 5, prime 2. And I, as a person, am perfectly comfortable with that, because the question is, are you doing this for flair or do you need this for a particular narrative effect? If it's the latter, then it gets much more complicated. And the we will mold reality like clay, but the clay contains shards of glass, I think is a good metaphor for magic. So I like reality is malleable but thorny. What do you think about that one?
I really like that one. I when I read this, it made me think that it would be nice to write this idea in 4 or 5 different ways and have them on slips of paper or cards or whatever at session zero and have your players pick the one they would like. Because I could see a version of this that is reality is malleable, but it springs back. Because this one makes me think you might stumble into something. You have to be careful. You know, it's treacherous. But that creates different stories than if I push it too hard, it'll push back. And it promotes you to think about magic differently. So I like the idea that you sort of write that repercussions of your magic in a few different thematic ways, and then let the players pick how they want to deal with repercussions. And it gives you kind of a prompt for how to think about paradox effects. I think that could be really interesting because, you know, with your example of the storm, that struck me about something that I remember being written about a fair bit in second edition, which was the skill of making an effect coincidental. And so if you are in a cloudy field and it's kind of stormy-ish already, you know, threatening to storm, you can probably just push it over the edge and draw that lightning bolt down with just forces. And it would probably be coincidental because maybe that's just the first lightning strike of this storm. But if you're in an open field on a sunny day and your paradigm is all about weather manipulation and summoning lightning, well, you're going to have to go vulgar. Storms don't come out of nowhere that quickly. And you're going to need all those other spheres. And I like the idea that maybe this tenet could speak to how you go about navigating this, how you go about hiding your effects as coincidental, because that skill is something that I always like engaging with my players on and making that a very overt part of how we create magic effects.
And I like, as you said, a bunch of variants. Another one can be reality can be sculpted just like titanium, which is to say it's doable. Yeah. It's just very hard. And most people yep. can't do it. The next one from Nibero said, let the dice fall as they may and find out what happens, which I think nicely states the idea of say yes or call for a die roll when a character is attempting something. And I go back and forth on this because to me, Mage is disproportionately a game where you do kind of say no, just because that just doesn't fit paradigmically. But given that, you can frequently let the character try just about anything. The thing about this is, let the dice fall as they may is kind of a directive of how to run a game, which is to say, like, honor the die results, don't fudge things, which is fine as a way of running it. So I like this one because it can be taken in so many different ways and kind of describes how a table wants to interpret rules. Another one is the second half of it. It says, and find out what happens. And this is kind of one of the dictums that comes up in games is play to find out what happens. And at this point, that can mean so many different things. One of the ways I interpret this is kind of introducing into Mage GM moves from Powered by the Apocalypse, which is basically to say, like, when your character fails at the lockpicking roll, it is not because they didn't pick the lock. It's because something happened in the plot to interrupt them. So you are now using a failure to keep the game moving. And I should probably do an episode on Terry's 5-part hierarchy of botches at some point. But this was a kind of a tenant on how to game. What did you think of this one, Victor?
I really like this. And I like your comment about GM moves. I find that let the dice fall as they may is one of those things I always want to do in role-playing games. And when the dice betray me as a player, I tend to get really giggly about it. I was playing in a Star Trek Adventures game, and there was one session where I rolled like 7 complications. I mean, it was stupid. By the end, I was just like, no, I don't want to take my action. I want to go curl up in the corner. Don't make me roll those dice. And they were all like, take your action. And I rolled another complication. And I went, this is on all of you. And I just thought it was funny and I laughed about it. But as the storyteller, I've definitely had situations with players where they get really upset when they are not successful enough. And I like the idea of sort of stating this up front. And again, having maybe a couple different levels of this, like let the dice fall as they may up to a level of statistical inevitability. Because I have had games where it was sucking the fun out of the session. And I read that and I went, nope. We're not going to do this anymore. This is a game. It should be fun. And knowing how your players feel about their dice, giving them the opportunity to kind of pick, I guess, a severity of this tenant at the start of the chronicle, I feel like would be really, really useful as a storyteller to know how I should approach repercussions and challenges and the 7 botch game session. You know, how should I handle that? How is that going to impact your mood? So I really like the idea of calling this out explicitly.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Star Trek Adventures, which is a fun game that, to me, if you play it a certain way, does produce an episode of Star Trek out the other end. And that's practically magic to me. One of the things the game does is it has a ballast mechanic. A ballast mechanic is anything that allows you to moderate extreme success or extreme failure. And it does that in the form of the momentum pool, which is basically you can build up successes that are excess to have points later to turn in. And by moderating the pool and how it accumulates, you get different games. So one of the things the game does that I think is interesting is if you have a character in an old World of Darkness game that for whatever reason gets to bring 10 dice to bear on a stupid task, you need to pickpocket something from a sleeping guard or something like that. And I have 10 dice and I get 8 successes. The game doesn't really tell you like what an extraordinary success on that is. Like there's only so well you can pickpocket that. But in a game that has player mechanics instead of just character mechanics, I get to turn, say, 5 of those successes into bonus points that I get to use later. Also, if I fail horribly, I get some momentum. I can turn in certain game resources to get momentum. And now I have this pool to draw from that will allow me to take extra dice, improve the results of effects and so on. In Octoon Cthulhu, those successes fuel magic. So your character being an awesome badass lets them do spells. Whereas in the Dune game, that momentum pool drains very quickly. It really wants to create a game where small advantages are leveraged for all they're worth. And just kind of tweaking that creates very different games in the same way that to me, Mage is a real different game if you do or don't use the optional rule of every time you sleep, you get a willpower point back. If you play with that rule and it doesn't get used, it is because you're playing a game that is so high stress that the kind of ability to collect yourself doesn't happen a lot. Where if you are playing with it, you can now kind of ramp up how adventurous the world is. And I find it impressive how much small rule changes like that can kind of affect things. Neil Patterson said, "You cannot opt out of the Ascension War. It looks different for different people. It does not always involve violence or overt conflict. But if you use magic, you are asserting a paradigm, a version of reality that is incompatible with someone else's." I like this idea that there are like no meta paradigms, really. I would argue that the Society of Aether is one of the only groups that has a meta paradigm. But for your magic to expand, something else has to retreat. We may generally think that that is a good thing if it returns wonder to the world, but the basic idea of the technocracy is that that cannot be safely done with multiple conflicting paradigms. The basic argument the tradition says is it is not wonder versus safety, but that we can maximize both, and they've just done a shit job of advancing both of those so far. But the you cannot opt out of the Ascension War. I think another way to take this in an interesting way is there are internal temptations in the same way that like there is an external and an internal notion of the jihad or something like that. I like the Ascension War also being how we talk about mages' attempt to accrue certain static power where they're like, no, once I hone this rote perfectly, I'm done. But for whatever reason, the world wants you to be more dynamic than that. I think there's a couple ways to take this, as well as the reminder that it does not always involve overt conflict or violence, that you can be outmaneuvered, you can be outmarketed, and that fists may come out and bullets may fly, but over the scale of centuries, a far more subtle war is raged.
I think with this one, what struck me is what this could illuminate. Like, I want to transform this one, but I don't quite know how, because I've gotten in arguments with like one true way first edition mage players before. I never thought I would find one, but there I was arguing with one. It was very strange. And the argument they ended up making is that nothing beyond their tradition should really exist, because anyone who had a spiritual paradigm, of course, would be the dream speakers, because they all had to coordinate together to push their vision of reality on the world. Otherwise, there was no game. And I was just very confused about the argument. And I was commenting on the weird position the dream speakers have in terms of the way they pull in a bunch of groups that wouldn't necessarily coordinate with all the other European powers in the traditions. But the thing his argument revealed to me was that the idea in this tenet, that no matter what you're doing, you are asserting your paradigm, you are fighting to make reality a certain way, sort of gets intermingled with and is in conflict with the actual like narrative meta ascension war, which is the officially stated political conflict between the traditions and the technocracy. And the thing I kind of want the tenet about the Ascension War to reveal to me as a storyteller is, how much do my players care about that political conflict? And how much do my players care about the little fights between me and the other mage, or the sleepers that just want the status quo to be maintained? Do they want that to constantly be there? Because this, to me, the way it's written right now, kind of speaks to mages that are overtly trying to avoid that big political conflict and find themselves increasingly drawn into other conflicts that are a reflection of it. And that's a legitimate story. I think this makes sense. But I can imagine a different version of it that speaks to the players just wanting to deal with those small, intimate mini ascension wars, or the players wanting to play the big political game. And this is another one where, like, I want there to be like five versions of this on the table in session zero and be like, which one of these do you want?
Well, I think my version of that is five different definitions of Ascension War.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another one was the idea that magic is the direct manipulation of reality by will, and that everything else is just a vehicle to help you get there is not common understanding among mages. Most mages believe they are doing whatever their paradigm says they are doing, and that their practice, not the unaided will, is the source of their ability.
I think this is just a good reminder.
Yeah.
This doesn't really read like a tenant to me. Like, it's good advice. It's a good reminder to not run the systems in game. It's so easy. And I've had so many players look at me and be like, but I have third level forces. So, and I'm like, no, your character does not have third level forces. You as a player are rolling third level forces. Your character has a mastery over these specific things within their paradigm, etc. And I think this is a really good thing to put in big block letters and have posted somewhere very easy to see at all of your game sessions to remind you of it. But I don't know that it's necessarily a tenant.
The next one from T.O. Webb says, the setting is innately absurd, but that does not mean it cannot be authentic or sincere. This is a world where there are evil corporations worshipping a snake god, a hollow earth, werewolves, vampires, twinkly fairies, nasty bitey fairies, ghosts, and an actual authoritarian Illuminati. There were a bunch of tenants that were ventured that kind of said something like this. Another good one was, the setting is nonsensical enough that it can take whatever you can throw at it. And I also like the idea that the absurd and the farcical are not the same thing. So it is hard to have a meaningful farce. It is very easy. Philosophically, as someone who identifies as an absurdist, it is weird to say absurdity can have great meaning, but here we are, my patron Saint Albert Camus. But just the idea that there are a lot of things, and to me, my way of dealing with that is I just don't call it that thing. I love having games where people don't know the political affiliations of another character. So one of my constant quests is to figure out who are the strange bedfellows in every tradition. Like, the common one I do is the Akashiana has probably more than one Greek Stoic in it. If the defining principle of the dream speakers are, there are other types of peoples, most humans do not recognize them, but they have wisdom. That to me means that UFO enthusiasts and like fairy hunters may also be in the dream speakers. And I don't know how I feel about that, but that is neither here nor there. But that is a test definition of the dream speakers I may run with in a game at some point and just have indigenous magics appear in every convention and tradition because they should. But Victor, what do you like about the idea that the setting is innately absurd?
I like the idea of this as a tenant. When I first read it, I thought, is this really a tenant or is this just a reminder about the setting? And I realized that maybe a somewhat more streamlined version of this would be a really good way to set the tone of your game, because you can do a very grounded mage game that de-emphasizes, you know, the fairies and the werewolves and the vampires and just gets deep into, you know, the horrible things that the syndicate does to crush, you know, your local community and how are you going to fight against them. Most people don't play that game, but like, that game is there, it's waiting to be picked up, and most people look at it and go, that looks drear. And I like the idea of having some tenets that speak to how deep into the absurdity do we want to get. You know, for me personally, I like the abstract and the absurd. This reminds me a lot of Centaur World, if anyone has seen it, which isn't necessarily a particularly mage story, although certain aspects of it are, but it's this deeply absurd, ridiculous, candy-colored, you know, trip for most of it. And then you get into these really deep, meaty character beats at the end of each season that use all of the absurdity that you had to wade through as the thing that makes you feel a certain way. And I watched the climax to season two multiple times because I was just like, they keep using these things that just came across as so stupid when they were introduced, but now they have symbolic meaning. And I think Mage is really good at that. I think the World of Darkness is good at that in general, but I think Mage and Changeling in particular excel at that absurdist symbolic meaning angle. And so I like this as a reminder. I think as a tenant to like remind you of something and direct your play, it would maybe need a little bit of refinement, but it points to something super useful.
I also feel that it is a reminder that presentation and framing are vital. At this point in my storytelling, never describe another character as being a vampire or a werewolf. I just kind of list attributes and affectations, and that can go into weird places. The palish person who shrinks away from the sunlight and talks about times long past as if they were still upon them. This was also a character that had who became a vampire around the time when Westinghouse and Edison were at war. So this character found electricity endlessly fascinating. So they just had all these antique odd objects around their haven. So the characters just kind of called him, like, just kind of thought all vampires in the world had something to do with electricity because they had only ever met one, and that's how it was. And the players knew of my fondness for remixing night folk. But like, the insistence on not calling something by a particular name, I think, leaves a lot of space for things to be filled in interesting ways, which kind of conceals the absurdity if you don't want that to come to the front. And the show you had mentioned, Centaur World, just running through the cast, Tony Hale plays Derpletoot, the voice given to Derpleton's flatulence after his wish is granted by the tree shamans. So that was a sentence I didn't know I was going to say today. This show is available on Netflix.
It is an experience.
Noted. Pukaji asks, should this be done as a table? I think this is a good chronicle tenant, because the idea that what would a table do is always a good way of focusing and dealing with the complications that come up in the world. That was a horrible joke. But more specifically, which of these, Victor, do you think of game tenants, setting tenants, and character tenants do you think should be done as a group?
I think that the game tenants should probably, and I know game tenants come from the game, but in Mage. Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned.
We don't got them yet.
Yeah, like you mentioned Technocracy should have its own game tenants. You know, Rich Bastard should have its own game tenants. I think within Technocracy, there's a set of Void Engineer settings that would have their own game tenants that even the rest of the Technocracy wouldn't have. So I do think there's something to be said for the storyteller pitching their setting and saying, here are the game tenants that I want to pluck out of Mage to give you an idea of the setting I have in mind. And at that point, you know, yeah, players could, in theory, try to veto that, but that kind of comes down to when a GM or storyteller pitches a game concept at you, do you listen to it and go, hey, I want to play that? And that would kind of be part of that vetting process. So I think that part probably wouldn't happen as a table, but I think character tenants and chronicle tenants should happen at a table. Even though you're not necessarily going to pick your character tenants democratically, I think as you pick them and design your characters, if you're sharing them with the table, that's going to help other people go, oh, you have that tenant. I'm going to have a similar tenant, so we're aligned. Or I'm going to have a tenant that's kind of opposed and a few tenants that are aligned. So there's tension between us, but it's playable tension. And I think there's a lot of productive troop design that could happen that way. And then I definitely think the chronicle tenants or the troop tenants that apply to your whole group, they could be about story, they could be about your particular, you know, cabal. Those should definitely happen as a group. And those should be sort of democratically, you know, maybe consensus, not voted, but some sort of democratically agreed upon.
I largely agree. I think there is a rich game to be had in having people set unconventional tenants, like, for instance, letting the players set one or two tenants. For instance, how supernatural the world is. The difference between the stories of vampires and werewolves are just that, stories. That creates one game. Whereas Strange Things Stalk the Shadows, Many More Powerful Than We, creates a different game. And saying, hey, which of these do you want to do, I think is cool. After the War is an interesting game, which plays with the idea of what if we could edit each other's character tenants. Basically, the game says anytime you lose a engagement role in some way, one of your tenants changes, and it can only be changed so many times before it is written. It goes from being written in pencil to being written in ink. And once your character has written all of their tenants in ink, they become an NPC because they no longer have the ability to change and evolve and are thus no longer characters. It also is the case that if you don't oppose another person in having something happen, you don't have to go through this process. So the game is kind of about how do we change as people in response to adversity, and what lengths would we go to avoid direct conflict? And that's kind of a fascinating meta game or game about a game unto itself. One day I will actually play it, done by friend of the show, Jason Pitt. Even in coming up with canon answers to the question of what is your setting, there are canon and non-canon ways to come across with that canon. And I think the very tools that we use can also be tinkered with and are game mechanics unto themselves.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I like that idea of changing your tenants in response to adversity, in response to trauma. I think that speaks to the way we calcify in the face of trauma. I personally like the idea, kind of getting back to an earlier tenant we talked about with the Fallen or the Marauders or Infernalism, that you can maybe erase an ink tenant, but that has to be a whole story and a willful endeavor in yourself that you see you're calcifying and you invest in making yourself malleable again, which gets to a lot of the purpose of high ritual magic and actual traditions, is resetting your calcified self into a malleable place where you can fix something in yourself, not fix as in correct something that's broken, but set a pattern into yourself in making yourself malleable. So I like that idea. It kind of reminds me of some of the quests you have to undertake to get rid of permanent banality and changeling. They could be really interesting, intimate, personal stories.
And with that, any more thoughts before I ask what you're up to?
No, I think that's a nice place to put a pin in it, actually. I like that thought as a conclusion.
Victor, are there any mage projects or mage adjacent projects you're working on these days? Or alternatively, if we're interested in hearing your hot takes, which are frequently merely tepid, where can we do that?
If you want to hear my tepid attempt at boiling takes, you can look me up on Twitter. That's where most things are posted. I've been a little less active recently, but I'm trying to kick myself into posting a little bit more there. I'm not currently doing any big projects publicly aside from guesting here occasionally. I have a couple podcast ideas I want to put together. I just need to find the time to produce them. And yeah, I mean, all my other mage energy right now is going into my personal campaign. I am running my first kind of out of the box central street level mystic mage campaign, and it's very strange. I've never done this before. It's so weird.
Victor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's always a blast.
This has been Mage the Podcast, where our podcast tenet is, if Terry can't find something to radically misrepresent about the topic, what even is the point? This episode was made possible by Sean Gallagher, Oracle of the Tenet, knowing is half the battle, the other half is violence. Benjamin Bendelow, Oracle of the Tenet, the real ascension are the calls we entered along the way. Buck Gregory, Oracle of the Tenet, that three's company, and that your game needs a wisecracking sidekick. Christopher Phillips, Oracle of the Tenet, that if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. That'll be your focus. Josh Hillerup, Oracle of the Tenant, never cross a Canadian if you value your life. Neil Patterson, Oracle of the Tenant, the best things in life are free if you're willing to steal. Jay Widener, Oracle of the Tenant, you can fool some of the people all the time, all the people some of the time, but to fool everyone all the time requires permanent quiet. Mikhail, Oracle of the Tenant, that you should never spit into the wind, because then the wind will have a valuable sympathetic connection to you for its future magical workings. And the crew of Erebus, Oracle of the Tenant, that anything that precisely follows the close form solution to the Black Scholes PDE is bunkum. Yes, I have strong feelings about finance. Additionally, I'd like to thank our other executive producers, Archmaster Andrew Adelstein, Archmaster Brad the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Semsek, Archmaster Guy Conan Stewart, Archmaster Jason Vines, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Patrick McNamara, Alex, Alexia, Anders S., Anon, Bedurfi, Birdo, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brendan, Bryce Perry, Chris B., Sin Shadis, Daniel Cuppin, Daniel Scribner, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Frager Rock, George Laura, Ia Bull, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Briggs, J.A. Gatsby, Jeff Bryn, Jenna F., John Magnuson, Julian Andes, Laws and Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Proyle, Michael Creedel, Michael Parker, Nathan Weaver, Nibero, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick Mulder, Puka G., Rachel Grace, Ralph Scheinhammer, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Candy, Samuel Tobin, Schnabelte Krieger, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, William Connolly, William Martin, and Zach Rules. As a note, this episode has an extra bonus for our executive producers that is available on the Patreon feed. Our EP shout-out this week is to Bedurfi, who I assume is an anagram of Be to Free, reminding us of the network of duty-free shops located in transit hubs and cruise ships around the world. I was pleased to learn that the duty-free shops on the U.S.-Canada border, best border in the world, are independently owned and operated by Canadians, but they do have their own trade association. I love that I can bring enough liquor back home from Canada to open a speakeasy, but the one time I was pulled into secondary inspection, I think it was because I had a visible banana in the car as well as some nuts. Additionally, I prefer to refer to these duty-free locations by their sign in French, which I simply call horse taxes. Bedurfi, next time I buy enough flavored vodka to black out an entire battalion, I'll think of you. If you'd rather listen on YouTube, search Mage the Podcast there to find our full library. If you super like this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at Mage the Podcast on Twitter. We have a hop in Discord community at discord.me/Mage the Podcast. Mage the Podcast is also on Mastodon at Mage the Podcast on dice.camp. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.